I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news for 30 years in two languages around the world and here in the United States. I've interviewed four presidents, co-founded a billion-dollar business, and you know what? I believe news should be honest, it should be direct, and it should be impactful. And this is Direct Impact. So let's begin with China. China is investing in Panama and investing big. Panama. The Xi Jinping government just completed a convention center there, and they're now officially running this massive port operation in the port of Balboa. All of it run by a Chinese-linked firm. And by the way, it's not just Panama. China's spending tons of billions of dollars all throughout Latin America, while putting on a full-court press with leaders from the region as well, inviting them to Beijing and then reciprocating in places like Argentina and Brazil and Ecuador and countless others, where those leaders go to Beijing and then the officials from Beijing, sometimes including Mr. Xi himself, end up going to those countries. What's with all this full-court press for Latin America, right? Are China's intentions in Latin America dubious or completely on the up and up? That is a matter of the chattering class in both Latin America and in the West to continue to debate, and oh, they will. But here's the reality. Nobody is turning down the money. And the great majority of the leaders there are welcoming Chinese cooperation with open arms. So what does all this signal, right, in Latin America? As the Wall Street Journal has written in a series of articles, this does not bode well for the United States. That's what the Wall Street Journal wrote. Why? Because fair or not fair, the consensus in Latin America is that while the U.S. historically has used political and military might in Latin America, the Chinese are generally interested in providing economic assistance, or so the story goes, right? That's what poll after poll appears to show when they ask these questions of people who live in those Latin American countries. There's another reality here, by the way. There's another reality here. A reality that China's influence worldwide, and especially in Latin America, is bringing about is this. The position of China's leader, stay with me here, that all of these movements that I just described about sending more business, creating ports, creating schools, building all these convention centers, that it's doing something for the positioning of China. And not just China, but China's leader, Xi Jinping, as the face of China's global rise and this newfound influence. So what's it doing? Well, this is kind of fascinating. Xi's position has elevated him to a kind of vaulted status among some, where he now feels comfortable enough to confront, for example, did you see what he did recently? Xi Jinping confronts the Canadian Prime Minister right to his face. This seems very not Chinese, at least in terms of what we think of the Chinese culture, but he came right up to the man, right up to his face, and kind of scolded him for disclosing to the press what he thought was a most private conversation. Here it is. Take a look.
Everything we discuss is then leaked to the paper. That's not appropriate. And that's not how the way the conversation was conducted. If there is sincerity on your part,
free and open and frank dialogue, and that is what we will continue to have, we will continue to look to work constructively together, but there will be things we will disagree on and we will have to continue.
Let's create the conditions first.
So some, with everything that we've seen and everything that we've talked about, are now comparing Xi to Mao Zedong, The Economist, Al Jazeera, The Wall Street Journal, the BBC, all are writing these articles where they talk about them, compare them, and or just some come out and say that it's actually time to maybe make the comparison. And she seemed to solidify that potential comparison in the latest Congress meeting, where with his successors out of the way, he deepened his control even more of the world's second largest economy, soon to be the world's top economy, by the way, if you read what many economists are saying that will happen in just 4 or 5, maybe 6 years. So how did she get to where he is? It almost makes me want to ask, maybe you too, who is this guy? Joining us now to talk about this is Sourav Gupta, who happens to be an expert on this topic. So maybe we start there. I'm starting, like the rest of the world, to become really curious. Who is this guy?
It's a fascinating question because, you know, in the Western world, it's already been, the answer is already laid out. Oh, she is the next Mao, or he is this authoritarian dictator, or totalitarian.
Yeah. But genius or monster, somewhere
exactly.
in between, right?
But they've already figured him out. And I'll say, you know, after this Congress, actually, he's become more of an enigma. Let me try to parse this a little bit as to who he is. She himself has spoken that modern Chinese history, I mean post-liberation, post-1949 history, should not be looked at as two eras of Mao, that authoritarian, centralizing political leader, and Deng, that reformist, economically minded, internationalist leader. It should not be framed in that context. The two are intertwined. Hmm. And she himself is perhaps an intertwining of the two. From a political perspective, he is a centralizer like Mao, although he hasn't centralized and made it a one-party dictatorship of the lines of Mao, including what Mao did institutionally. She is still very much part of that larger central committee, but he has no doubt about many levers of control. But from an economic standpoint, his economic agenda is built exactly on that agenda which Deng laid down. Hmm. I mean, one can get trapped in some of the jargon. Deng talked of a principal contradiction in 1981. She talked about that in 2017. Deng talked of international circulation as part of opening up. She talks of dual circulation. It's basically on that foundation that Deng laid is the next stage of reform and opening up. It's even called a new round of reform and opening up. So from an economic standpoint, he's very much Deng's successor. What I would say is that he's not as economically liberal as Deng is, and at the same time, he's not as politically conservative as Mao was. Mm. And so he is a mix of the two, and that's why that creates, it's an enigmatic mix in a way.
Here's the $60,000 question that I think most of the people who are watching this right now would probably think. Is he a communist?
Totally. In his own view, in his view, he is very, very committed to the communist Marxist theoretical dialectic. Mm. But that dialectic, as we've seen through that in phases of reform and opening up, is infinitely extensible and co-optable in terms of how it is from a capitalist and economic standpoint. It is, and it's in.
Yeah, because I have to stop you for a minute, because I'm just thinking that you just said that to me, and as you're using the word communist, I'm thinking of Huawei. I'm thinking about the greatest chip industry perhaps anywhere in the world. How can those things be at the same time? Aren't they contradictory?
I think they are contradictory, and I'll tell you this, and I'll be very frank about what is Xi's socialism with Chinese characteristics. I'll be blunt about it. It is an exercise in opportunism. All that works is Chinese communism, is socialism with Chinese characteristics in the new era. All that doesn't work, it's got nothing to do with it. He knows.
So I think what I'm hearing you say is, if it makes money for the people, i.e., for the country, for Xi, essentially. Not that he's pocketing it. I'm not accusing him of doing that. Although I'm sure he lives pretty large. If it works for the country, then it's good. If it doesn't, get out of here, right?
Yes, it
does. Well, isn't that the same rule that capitalists live by?
Precisely. I think of Xi, when I talk about this, I think about Bill Clinton. You know, Bill Clinton, all the good things happen because of me, all the bad things happen because of other persons.
Right.
And that's exactly socialism with Chinese characteristics in the new era.
Right. So a company like Huawei makes him proud because it's the number one mobile phone manufacturer in the entire world. Yeah. Wow, that's a win. So it's allowed to compete with Apple or whatever other big company that we can compare it to here in the United States, even though it's a completely capitalistic venture, living within a communist environment.
Yes.
But any other company that comes along that doesn't get the sanctioning of the government, we're not even going to let you grow.
Yeah.
That's the rule?
That's a rule. But the government itself takes a pretty broad view of what can play, who can play and who cannot. And yes, you know, in the last 2 years, there's been a lot about how he's smashing down Alibaba, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. If one looks in retrospect, the digital media requires antitrust regulation. He has the courage to bring the hammer down on those folks. You'd wish they'd do it in this country a little bit more, where digital media have become so powerful that and have such great lobbying power that they're now beyond regulation. Crypto tried to go that way. It's had a little problem of
late. Yeah, let's not even go to crypto right now.
But that's the point about China. I mean, they have ample, think about it. You know, the hit on Xi is that, oh, he's trying to centralize the, not just politically, but also the state-owned enterprises. In the last 10 years, what has blossomed the most? The digital economy. Every one of those players are private players. The property sector brings so much, it's having a problem in China right now. It's all private players.
That's a fascinating thing you say, because it leads us into the next part of the conversation, and I was alluding to this just a little while ago, what's happening in places like Latin America. And by the way, we use Latin America because, well, I happen to be a Latino, so I understand a little bit about what's going on in Latin America. You say it's important for them to have some kind of dominion in the tech space, for example. And at the same time, I was just referring to how many businesses in Latin America, how many convention centers they're opening, how many ports they're now working. All of this is happening at the same time. While if you go to Latin America and you talk to Pedro down there or Maria or Felicity or whoever, or King Sabe, as we say in Latin America, guess what they take out of their pocket? A phone that is made by Huawei or a phone or some other technology that is Chinese-based. Yeah. So they're really working two prongs, while at the same time they're introducing all these things and creating power plants, et cetera, et cetera. They're also making sure that all Latin American citizens down there, their first time they can afford a phone, first time they can afford a TV, first time they can afford any kind of technology, it'll be Chinese technology, where 50 years ago it used to be an RCA.
Yes. Exactly correct. Exactly correct. They're going in the hard infrastructure space because they've done infrastructure so well at home. So they know they can take it abroad. And the Western countries sneer at it, so they can't come to the West, even though they are the Portugals and all who have allowed them to play. But so they go to Africa. They go to Latin America, who are willing, open, and willing. And
I want a cheap phone.
Yeah, exactly.
I want a cheap phone. I can't afford to pay for you know, whatever it is that most of our friends use in the United States.
Precisely. And in things like fintech and all, which Alibaba created, I mean, using the digital universe, Latin America is underserved in that area. There are business models that China has perfected, that the private players in China have perfected at home, which they're taking out. And yes, there's the worry that there might the surveillance issue might be a problem. But if you ask an average African, developing Asian, or Latin American country, they will know. I mean, the United States government will get the information it needs that it needs to get from a private citizen in Latin America when it wants to. And the Chinese can get it, the Russia, the United States can get it. Who cares?
Wow, Sourabh, what a fascinating conversation. I learned so much when I talked to you. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Really appreciate it. By the way, conversations like this I find fascinating. I have them a lot. In fact, I have a podcast where I, as a journalist, as a Latino, as a co-founder of a billion-dollar company, share my stories, what I've learned, how many times I've screwed up horribly, stuff that I wasn't able to get right, and the times I've been lucky enough to succeed and grow. And that's what I'd like to help you do as well. It's called the Rick Sanchez Podcast. I invite you to check it out. I'll see you there. But when we come back, well, Lula da Silva wins in Brazil. Que pasó? Does it signal a move to the left in Latin America? Back in a minute.
the Chagos Archipelago, home of the Chagosians. Diego Garcia, the largest island in the archipelago, is now the location of a very large U.S. military base.
UK government give our island to the U.S. government to make a military base and just deported all the Chagosan people from their country, so they can't return back on the island.
Never.
Never, but we are fighting. That's why we are fighting for the rights of return.
We do not consider that the right of self-determination actually applies to the Chagossians. And on the question of self-determination, the legal advice we've received is actually the Chagossians were not and are not a people.
For me, it's time to move on and see what we can do for the Chagossian community to return back home.
There's no support from the United Nations High Commission of Refugees.
United Nations don't care about Chagossian people.
What happens when you mix digital games with actual physical sports?
Something like digital?
The answer is yes.
Kazan is preparing to host the first ever Games of the Future, a cyber contest with a physical dimension. One of the innovators, Igor Stolyarov, is on the verge of redefining sports and gaming. He tells us what's behind this synergy and if it's the future.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. So, what are we to make of the latest U.S. elections? If you look at the numbers, it's pretty amazing. Well, maybe rather than take you through all these numbers, let me just say this. And maybe it is just this. Polls seem to be wrong an awful lot these days. The U.S. midterms, which is the election held at the midpoint of the president's four-year term, is usually a painful experience for the person in the White House, right? This midterm election was supposed to be no different. After all, the president, Mr. Biden, is not popular by any stretch of the imagination. Add to that the highest prices in decades, you know, that inflation thing, a predicted recession coming around the corner, and what you have is the makings of a red wave. That's what they called it in America. America's about to be hit by a red wave, meaning Republicans are about to be elected in big numbers. I mean, really big numbers. And that's what everybody expected. But then something funny happened. Instead of Republicans getting more votes than ever, as predicted, instead of taking over the House of Representatives, as predicted, and taking back the Senate, Republicans barely took the House. They're supposed to win by 20 to 30 new Senate seats, House seats. Instead, they won by a handful, and they actually lost the Senate. Joining us now to talk about this is Ben Norton. He's an investigative journalist that usually tells stories, well, from a more real perspective than those that you would read on your run-of-the-mill newspapers anywhere in the world, for that matter. So maybe, Ben, this is where we start this conversation. Maybe we start with this. Because I know I have my perspective, and I know that usually if you have a Democratic president in a midterm, the Republicans will win the midterm. And if you have a Republican president, the Democrats will win the midterm. But that didn't seem to happen this time, at least not the way it was supposed to. So how would you define the results for the U.S. midterm elections? Would you describe this as a victory for the Democrats after they retained the Senate majority?
Well, I'm actually not that surprised at the midterm election results. The reality is that, yes, the Republicans didn't do as well as some people thought with a red wave, but the Democrats didn't do great either. And I think we can expect a kind of lame duck presidency. The irony is that Biden has pretty much already been a lame duck president, even though he technically has a slim majority in the Senate already and in the House as well, but he hasn't really able to pass any legislation because of the opposition of the Democratic Congress people, specifically Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema.
So with Democrats taking the Senate and Republicans taking the House, follow me here, is it safe now to say, Ben, that Americans are going to prefer what it seems like they got? a divided government.
This is a talking point we often hear from, you know, Ivy League political scientists who say that the people of the United States want a divided government. I actually think the people of the United States want a government that acts on behalf of their economic interests. And the reality is that since the 1970s, the U.S. government has been dominated by neoliberal economic policies that act on behalf of Wall Street and the financial sector and not on behalf of working people in the United States. That's why we've seen since 1978, real wages have persistently declined or stagnated in the United States. And we've seen that as technological advances have allowed for increases in production, wages have stagnated. That's to say that workers now are more productive than they were in the 1970s, and yet their wages are actually weaker. And why is that? Because we see a captive government dominated by the financial sector. Large corporations and banks control the U.S. government and the political system. And the Supreme Court basically made bribery legal with Citizens United. It says that essentially there is no limit on corporations funding that is bribing politicians. And that's why studies show, academic studies from scholars at Princeton University have shown that average working people in the United States don't have an impact on actual government policy. It's only large economic interests, billionaires, big corporations, banks, think tanks in Washington that are funded by those interests. And in terms of congressional races, year after year, we see that the congressional candidates who have more funding win over 90% of the time. So I think focusing on a divided government and all of that is actually really a distraction from the real issue, which is that a lot of people in the United States don't have confidence in the government. Polls show that people, only around 20% of people in the United States actually have confidence in the White House. That's true of regardless of whether or not it's a Democrat or Republican. And congressional approval is in the single digits. That is to say that the majority of Americans are actually disillusioned. They don't have confidence in the government. And yes, it's common that when a Republican is president, the Democrats tend to win control of Congress. And when a Democrat is president, the Republicans tend to win control of Congress. I don't think that's because Americans want a divided government. I think it's because they vote for a president thinking the president might change something. Things never change because that president is funded by a bunch of big corporations and banks. So 2 years later, the people decide they want to have another change. And we just see this constant flip-flop going back and forth and back and forth. And the reality is that people have very little confidence. Finally, another very important point to keep in mind is that the participation, the voter turnout in U.S. elections is consistently low, not only in presidential elections, where it's usually around half of the population, but especially in midterms. We consistently see that voter turnout is around 20 or 30%, which is extremely low. Sometimes it's even lower than that. That reflects the fact that the majority of people in the United States don't have confidence in the system. So the problem is not that people want a divided government. The problem is that they want a government that represents them. And that doesn't happen because of all the big money in politics.
Let me ask you this. Would you say that even with the Republicans taking the House, that we can expect that very little will change in terms of big issues, whether it's inflation, Ukraine, relationships with China, et cetera, that really on those issues, things won't change that much from a political standpoint?
Well, the situation of nothing happening pretty much is the status quo. The Biden administration has not passed any serious legislation, and it's been in power for 2 years. Let's not forget that it was Joe Biden himself who said during the presidential campaign, he told wealthy donors in New York, he said, if I'm president, nothing will fundamentally change. And nothing indeed has fundamentally changed. And a lot of that is because even though the Democrats had a very slim control of both chambers of Congress, the Democratic Party itself could not pass any legislation because of the opposition of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. That is to say that Biden claims that maybe he wanted to have, you know, an ambitious infrastructure bill and spending to try to reinvigorate the economy, and his own party opposed those policies. So Biden never really had ambitious promises. He never clearly wanted to implement any ambitious change. He told his donors that, and he hasn't made any significant change And now that the Congress is probably going to be even further divided, especially if Republicans have a slim majority in the House, I don't expect any serious legislation to be passed. The reality is that the United States, the internal politics in the United States, is completely paralyzed by this insane partisan battle between two parties who honestly agree on 90% of economic issues and foreign policy. The Republicans and Democrats support war. They support neoliberal economic policies of supporting big corporations and banks. The real differences they have are on cultural issues, which is why we constantly see this obsession with culture war, focusing on abortion and attacking LGBT people and racism and all of that. I'm not saying those issues aren't important. They are important. But what we actually see is that all of the other issues, the economic situation, foreign policy, all of that is ignored, basically. And now we see, you know, with the war in Ukraine, yes, there are some voices in the Republican Party who are criticizing the Biden administration for giving tens of billions of dollars to fuel this war, this brutal proxy war, instead of pushing for peace, instead of pushing for a diplomatic solution. But the reality is that still, the majority of the Republican Party is on board with this NATO proxy war. And that not only do they support the NATO proxy war, they want war on China. So even some of the Republicans who say that they're against the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, that's because they instead want to focus on waging war on China. So the reality is that, unfortunately, warmongering is completely bipartisan in U.S. politics. And if the Congress is divided, or even if the Republicans have a majority, I still don't expect any real change to happen.
Thanks so much, Ben. We really appreciate that. So, by the way, before we go, let me do this. I want to share my mission with you. It's simple, really. I want to de-silo the world, and that's why we do this newscast. We've got to stop living in these little boxes where we live right now. Truths don't live in boxes. Truth is everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you again right here, where I hope to provide you with a direct impact.